Today is Monday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Gene Ruofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. travel restrictions take effect for some African nations in an effort to contain the new Omicron coronavirus.
The U.S. is joining the European Union, Canada, and Russia in restricting travel to and from about a half dozen nations in southern Africa.
France's interior minister hosts a meeting on the migrant crisis with Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and the European Commission without Britain.
Many migrants at this northern French camp say they still want to make the perilous crossing to Britain, despite the capsizing of a dinghy last week that claimed the lives of 27 people.
And Taiwan says 27 Chinese aircraft entered its air defense buffer zone as part of Beijing's pressure on the Silk Road Islands. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. On Monday, U.S. travel restrictions will take effect on some African nations in an effort to contain the new variant of the coronavirus. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The U.S. is joining the European Union, Canada, and Russia in restricting travel to and from about a half dozen nations in southern Africa and South Africa, where this new variant, Omicron, was first detected.
We're going to be cautious, make sure there's no travel.
President Biden made the announcement to reporters during his Thanksgiving break as he walked around Nantucket, Massachusetts.
We don't know a lot about the variant except that it is a great concern. It seems to spread rapidly.
He says the travel ban does include exemptions for returning U.S. citizens, permanent residents, and spouses as long as they test negative. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The new Omicron coronavirus variant kept spreading around the world on Sunday, with 13 cases found in the Netherlands and two each in Denmark and Australia. Edward Baran of Reuters reports.
The new Omicron coronavirus variant kept spreading around the world on Sunday, with 13 cases found in the Netherlands and two each in Denmark and Australia. It came even as more countries tried to seal themselves off by imposing travel restrictions. The Dutch health minister said 13 cases of the variant were found among passengers who were on flights from South Africa that arrived in Amsterdam on Friday. Authorities had tested all of the more than 600 passengers on those two flights and had found 61 coronavirus cases, going on to test those for the new variant. First discovered in South Africa, the variant has now been detected in several countries around the world, from Germany to Australia to Israel. Last week, Omicron was dubbed a variant of concern by the World Health Organization. It sparked worries around the world that it could resist vaccinations and prolong the nearly two-year COVID-19 pandemic. Omicron is potentially more contagious than previous variants, although experts don't know yet if it will cause more or less severe COVID-19 compared to other strains. However, the chair of the South African Medical Association, Angelique Kutsia, said in her experience its symptoms were mild.
There's no reason for panicking as we don't see severely ill patients. It might change going forward. But the hype that's been created currently out there in the media and worldwide doesn't correlate with the clinical picture.
Countries have imposed a wave of travel bans or curbs on southern Africa to try to stem the spread.
That's Edward Baran of Reuters. A South African doctor who was among the first ones in the country to suspect a different variant of the coronavirus among patients said on Sunday that symptoms of the Omicron variant were so far mild and could be treated at home. Dr. Angelique Kotze, a private practitioner and chair of South African Medical Association, told Reuters that on November 18th, she noticed seven patients reporting at her clinic who had symptoms different from the currently dominant Delta variant, albeit they were, quote, mild, unquote. Now designated Omicron by the World Health Organization, the variant was detected and announced by South Africa's National Institute of Communicable Diseases on November 25th from samples taken from a laboratory from November 14th to November 16th. Kotze said a patient on November 18 reported at her clinic being, quote, extremely fatigued, unquote, for 2 days with body aches and headache. On the same day, more patients came in with similar symptoms, which was when she realized there were, quote, something else going on, unquote. Since then, she has seen two to three patients a day.
And the overall patients that was recorded yesterday was 3,000 and around about 3,700. So our positivity rate is 9.2%. It is, yes, it is more than we would have loved it to be. But looking at the mildness of the symptoms that we are seeing, currently there is no reason for panicking as we don't see severely ill patients. I also checked with the hospital, some of the hospitals in my area, and one of the biggest hospitals, they only have one patient currently that's COVID positive on a ventilator, and they don't even know whether it's COVID, it's Delta or whether it is Omicron related. Even the provincial hospital, the biggest one, Steve Biko, not really seeing a lot of adults. They do, however, see a higher index of children coming in with COVID-19. And these children has not been vaccinated. So the clinical picture for us is extremely important. And we acknowledge that it might change going forward.
That's Dr. Angele Kodze, Chair of South African Medical Association. Australia has brought in travel bans and new quarantine orders because of concerns about the new Omicron COVID-19 variant first reported in Southern Africa. Two cases have been discovered in travellers arriving in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Urgent testing is underway to determine whether passengers infected with COVID-19 who've arrived in Sydney from Southern Africa are carrying the Omicron variant. The travellers have been taken to so-called special health accommodation, where they'll spend 14 days in quarantine. The World Health Organization has declared Omicron a variant of concern as researchers work to establish whether it's more infectious than other strains. Australia has moved quickly to impose strict border controls. Non-citizens from 9 Southern African countries are banned. They are South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Lesotho, Eswatini, formerly known as Swaziland, the Seychelles, Malawi and Mozambique. Australian citizens and their families who've spent time in those countries during the past 2 weeks must go into isolation on their return home. Passengers arriving from all other countries would be required to isolate for 72 hours on arrival into the states of New South Wales and Victoria, which have seen Australia's worst COVID-19 outbreaks this year. Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt says a cautious approach is needed.
The Australian government will be implementing additional precautionary border security measures in order to protect Australians whilst more is learnt about the nature and impact of the Omicron variant of concern. There are currently no known cases of the Omicron variant in Australia.
Health authorities in New South Wales have said that the new variant isn't well understood and warned that it may be already in Australia. The Omicron variant has been detected in Belgium, Germany, Hong Kong, Israel, Italy and the United Kingdom. It's less than a month since New South Wales and Victoria, Australia's most populous states, removed all quarantine requirements for fully vaccinated international arrivals. Australia has recorded 206,000 COVID-19 cases and almost 2,000 deaths since the pandemic began. Currently, 536 patients need hospital care, according to the health department. More than 85% of the eligible Australian population is fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Moderna's chief medical officer said on Sunday that if a new vaccine to tackle the Omicron variant of coronavirus was needed, it would likely be ready early next year. Speaking on BBC's Andrew Moore show, Dr. Paul Burton, chief medical officer at the biotech company, said it would take a couple of weeks to know whether the current available vaccines can provide protection against the variant. The Omicron variant has been spreading around the world with 13 cases found in the Netherlands and 2 each in Denmark and Australia, with more and more countries imposing stricter travel restrictions. Dr. Paul Burton.
We've mobilized hundreds of people here in the US and around the world. We started that really early on Thursday, on Thanksgiving Day. We should know about the ability of the current vaccine to provide protection in the next couple of weeks. But the remarkable thing about the mRNA vaccine, the Moderna platform, is that we can move very fast. If we have to make a brand new vaccine, I think that's going to be early 2022, before that's really going to be available in large quantities. You know, I think we have cause to be hopeful. We've learned a lot about this virus in general. You know, we've learned so much about how to deal with COVID as well, through simple measures and obviously through vaccines. But until we see how this virus now behaves in populations of older people, people with other comorbidities, we really will not get a handle on exactly how severe the disease could be, I think. I think the message now is, if people are on the fence and you haven't been vaccinated, get vaccinated. If you're eligible, and I believe in the UK, over 40-year-olds are eligible for one of the vaccines, and you can mix the boosters as well, get boosted. I think we have some experiments that need to get done. This is a dangerous looking virus, but I think we have many tools in our armamentarium now to be able to fight it. So I'm optimistic.
That's Dr. Paul Barton, Chief Medical Officer at a biotech company. French Interior Minister Gérard Darmanin held a meeting on the migrant crisis on Sunday in Calais with his counterparts from Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and the European Commission. The meeting follows the death of 27 migrants trying to cross the English Channel last Wednesday. It was tragedy on record in one of the world's busiest shipping lanes. Last week, Prime Minister of Great Britain, Boris Johnson, wrote to French President Emmanuel Macron, setting up five steps the two countries could take to deter migrants from making the perilous journey. However, France canceled an invitation to British Interior Minister Priti Patel to attend the Calais meeting after Johnson published a letter on Twitter. Lucy Field of Reuters reports.
Many migrants at this northern French camp say they still want to make the perilous crossing to Britain, despite the capsizing of a dinghy last week that claimed the lives of 27 people.
Parce que vivre ici, c'est juste impossible.
Living here is simply impossible, says NGO worker Pascaline Delaby. What happened last week will happen again if nothing changes. French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin convened his counterparts from Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium and the EU in Calais on Sunday to tackle the migrant crisis. The UK's Priti Patel was disinvited after British Prime Minister Boris Johnson posted an open letter to President Emmanuel Macron last week, demanding that France agree on joint patrols and take back the migrants that make it to Britain. French authorities routinely dismantle migrant camps such as this to discourage migrants from coming and attempting the crossing to Britain. But still, they haul their rubber dinghies over the dunes towards the icy waters of the Channel. This group of 40 migrants, including women and children, were filmed casting off from northern France last Wednesday.
Ma quanti migranti?
Pope Francis dedicated nearly all of his Sunday message at the Vatican to the support of migrants, urging authorities to respect their humanity and strive to help them.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. In Italy, the Coast Guard has rescued about 250 migrants, including a newborn baby, from a boat drifting a few miles off the coast of the Calabria region. A Coast Guard statement said the rescue carried out overnight on Saturday and Sunday was complicated by difficult weather and sea conditions and lasted more than 16 hours. A total of 244 people were saved. Among them were 41 minors, including the baby born on the boat on Saturday. Italy has seen a sharp increase in boat migrants in recent weeks, and the latest arrivals will put pressure on Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government to secure an agreement with the European Union partners over how to deal with the influx. Another 296 migrants were saved from Italian Coast Guard in the Mediterranean on November 25. Another 296 migrants were saved by the Italian Coast Guard in the Mediterranean on November 25th as they tried to reach Europe. In a separate statement, German NGO Sea-Watch said on Saturday that 461 people are disembarking from its rescue ship in Augusta, Sicily. Data from Italy's Interior Ministry shows some 62,236 migrants have landed in the country so far in 2021, against 32,542 in the same period last year. Hundreds of military detainees released this month in Nigeria's Borno state are trying to settle back into camps and their communities. But rights group Amnesty International is calling on Nigerian authorities to free hundreds more, it says, have been held for years without trial. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Musa Adamu was working on a farm in Mungunu, Borno State, in May 2017, when he said he and many other farmers in the nearby village of Gwoza were picked up by the military and labeled as members of the Islamic militant group Boko Haram. Adamu says they were first detained at a military barrack and later transferred to the maximum security prison in Maiduguri, the Borno State capital, where they were held for more than 4 years without trial. Adamu is one of the hundreds freed by Nigerian military authorities this month after increased calls by rights groups. Among them was NIFA Women, a coalition of displaced women campaigning for the release of their husbands and sons from military detention. The group has been assembling informally since 2012, but their voices gained more recognition after Hamzatu Alamin, a popular human rights activist, founded a non-governmental organization in 2017 to help amplify complaints their sons or husbands disappeared following military raids. She says at least 6,000 mothers have come forward to register their missing sons, and thousands of others say their husbands are missing.
They now started speaking confidently. In fact, we supported them to write petition. Now we have made a database of the missing and the disappeared. We have about 6,400 of the mothers whose sons were missing. And then for the NIFA women whose husbands were missing from the local government, we have over 7,000 of them.
The Nigerian military too often has been accused by rights groups of profiling and unlawful arrest of citizens perceived to be members of Boko Haram. Alamin says through their advocacy, the military is changing tactics and becoming more careful. In July, the Nigerian army freed 1,009 Boko Haram suspects after profiling and acquitted them of any involvement with the armed group. Alamin says years of advocacy are paying off.
Eventually, the military has responded. They are releasing them bit by bit, and then those in prison also are being released. So then eventually our relationship became very, very good.
While Amnesty International praised authorities for the release of the detainees, spokesperson Sheun Bakari says many more face uncertain futures in various military camps.
We are aware that hundreds more are still in a lawful detention, and they've never stood trial, and they're actually being illegally detained. And of course, we know that this situation puts their lives in danger.
Musa Adamu is yet to reunite with his long separated family seeking shelter at a separate camp. He wants to get back to work so he can send his children to school. For Alamin and the NIFA women, the struggle to free more men will continue. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In other news, Taiwan said 27 Chinese aircraft entered its air defense buffer zone on Sunday, the latest in a long series of incursions as part of Beijing's pressure on the self-ruled island. The defense ministry said Taiwan scrambled combat aircraft to, quote, warn, unquote, the Chinese planes to leave. It also deployed missile systems to monitor them. Taiwanese Defense Ministry says Sunday's incursion included 18 fighter jets and 5 HB bombers, as well as a Y-20 area refueling aircraft. A map by Chinese authorities showed the Chinese aircraft flew into the air defense's identification zone, near the southern part of the island, and out into the Pacific Ocean before returning to China. Over the past year, the frequency of Chinese incursions has increased with about 150 aircraft over a period of 4 days. China's state-run Xinhua News Agency says the air mission towards Taiwan comes as Chinese President Xi Jinping met with officers at a military conference where he called for military talent cultivation to support and strengthen the armed forces. According to the news outlet, Xi said that talent is imperative in achieving victory in military competition and gaining the upper hand in future wars. Taiwan and China split during a civil war in 1949, and Beijing opposes China's involvement in international organizations. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Protesters in Burkina Faso called Saturday for the president's resignation over the government's handling of security. Harry Wilkins, reporting for VOA from the streets of Ouagadougou, spoke to activists and analysts about what the demonstration means for the country.
About 8 a.m. Saturday, protesters began to gather near the Place de Revolution in downtown Ouagadougou. Military police had already cordoned off the square to prevent protests, which the mayor of Ouagadougou called illegal on Thursday.
Protesters have been fighting running battles with the municipal police for about 2 hours now. Security forces are driving up and down the streets of the downtown area of Ouagadougou, firing tear gas at large groupings of people. Many journalists have been tear gassed as well, myself included.
This was after we identified ourselves as journalists to police. Protests have spread across Burkina Faso in the last week, with demonstrators calling for the resignation of President Roch Kabore because of his handling of security during his 6 years in power. In that time, terror groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State have spread across the country. An attack on a military base in Ennahda in the north of the country saw more than 50 military police killed and triggered the recent protests. Meanwhile, demonstrators also blockaded a French military convoy in the city of Kaya last weekend, claiming the French were arming terror groups. There is no evidence to support that claim. One protester, who did not give their name, explained Saturday why they were protesting in the streets. No, we are here today to ask Roch Marc Christian Kabore, who has shown himself to be nothing but mediocre. We're simply asking that he resign, said the protester. Another said this. My logic, it is to march to show the government our dissatisfaction with the management of the security crisis, which is grieving Burkina Faso today. On Thursday night, President Kabore made a televised address to the nation. He implored the youth of the country to exercise restraint in the face of protests and misinformation, and said he would reorganize the military, implement an anti-corruption drive, and announce the results of an inquiry into the Ennahda attack. I will watch scrupulously, more than previously, questions of logistics, bonuses, and strengthening the operational capacity of our fighting forces, said the president. The Ennahda base had not been supplied with food for 2 weeks prior to the attack. Andrew Leibovich is a policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. He says it's too early to draw conclusions about what these protests mean for the government moving forward. Many Burkinabe want the government to improve security because of ongoing attacks and the widespread perception the security situation is getting worse every day. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Scattered internet outages and slowdowns were reported across Iran Saturday as the government cracked down on water protests in Isfahan this past week. Dozens of protesters in the Isfahan region reportedly were arrested by government security forces to clamp down on the protesters, although smaller protests have been reported in other parts of the country. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Amateur video posted on social media showed protesters Saturday outside Iran's third largest city of Isfahan blocking roads to disrupt traffic into the region and preventing government security forces from continuing their clampdown on protests over a water shortage on the Zayandarud River. Dozens of protesters reportedly were arrested over the past 48 hours. Iranian opposition groups reported that internet service was being disrupted across many parts of the country, making it difficult to gather information about protests Saturday following a large turnout of protesters in Isfahan Thursday and Friday. Iranian military commander General Mohammad Reza Mir Haidari told government TV that protests Saturday were limited in scope and that the security forces had the situation under control. The BBC Persian service reported that two student protesters at Isfahan University were in serious condition following demonstrations Friday, while an opposition Iranian human rights group said three people had been killed by gunfire or tear gas canisters during the past 24 hours. VOA could not independently confirm the death toll. Amateur video posted on social media showed government security forces and volunteer militia forces firing tear gas at protesters. Some reports indicated the security forces also fired live ammunition. VOA could not independently confirm the reports. Amateur video showed a young protester coughing after tear gas was fired in his direction during water protests in Isfahan Friday. Other video showed clouds of tear gas floating over the heads of protesters along a major Isfahan thoroughfare. Mirdad Khansari, a former Iranian diplomat now based in London, tells VOA the government violence has silenced protesters in Isfahan, but that resistance continues in other places.
The use of violence in Isfahan has reportedly been so excessive that it has quieted down in that particular spot. But there have been a resurgence of resistance in other areas of Iran, not related to that particular spot, and that is not under control.
Khansari goes on to say that people in Iran have lost the optimism that existed when former President Hassan Rouhani came to power amid hopes for a nuclear deal and a better economic situation. The level of pessimism, he argues, has returned to that of the Ahmadinejad era, and the current president, Ibrahim Raisi, has no economic means to appease the people, given the oil embargo reimposed on Iran by former U.S. President Trump. Social media reported scattered protests Saturday in Tabriz and Ahmedabad. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Former South Korean military dictator Shin Jong-un died Tuesday at his home at the age of 90. As Lee Hwan Choi reports for VOA, victims of his authoritarian regime and democracy activists are determined to continue the fight for historic justice even after his death.
Chun Doo-hun, an army general at the time, seized power in 1979 through a military coup. While Chun oversaw significant economic achievements during his rule, his legacy is marred by records of severe human rights violations. Chun is held to be responsible for one of the bloodiest massacres in modern South Korean history, the Gwangju Massacre. In May 1980, more than 15,000 students took to the streets of the southwestern city of Gwangju to call for the end of Chun's military dictatorship. When Chun's forces arrived in the city, local government figures showed that they killed more than 200 civilians, injured several thousand, and arrested more than 1,800 civilians. 41 years later, the military strongman died in his home in Seoul, leaving no apology behind. Now, families of victims and survivors of the Gwangju massacre are grappling with Jun's sudden death. Lee Gi-bong, who heads a civic group formed by victims of the Gwangju incident, says Jun's death did not resolve the trauma. He says that the criminals who wielded state violence lived long lives and died in wealth. Meanwhile, he says, the pain of Gwangju citizens continues. Though Jun's passing has left an open wound, many victims are determined to prevent his death from burying the truth of Gwangju. Lee Jae-ui participated in the uprising as a university student. He says it's regrettable Jun denied the massacre and his responsibility until the very end. But now, he says survivors must attend to the historical task of completing the fact-finding mission in order to tie up the loose ends without him. Crackdown still provokes political tension. Many of Chun's conservative followers defend the use of force. They allege, without evidence, that the protests in Gwangju were directed by North Korean infiltrators. Gwangju citizens often still face accusations they were communist spies threatening national security. Last month, conservative presidential candidate Yoon Suk-yeol came under criticism for praising Chun's political skills, aside from the coup and the events of May 1980. Yoon later visited Gwangju to apologize for his remark, but was blocked by protesters from entering the victim's altar. Instead, he delivered a silent tribute at the entrance.
이 전두환의 그 파장이나 자장이 지금도 여전히 큰 그림자를 남기고 있는 것이죠.
Lee, the former Gwangju protester, says true healing and reconciliation will never be achieved while people continue to spread unfounded accusations. He says only when the shadows of Chun's influence are fully lifted from South Korean society will the country be able to make meaningful progress towards democracy. After Chun's death, about 70 victims of the Gwangju massacre filed a lawsuit against the government alleging emotional trauma. It's further evidence that even though a dark chapter of South Korea's history has closed, much of the trauma remains unresolved. Lee Hyun-che for VOA News, Seoul.